Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb. On today's episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, I'm going to be speaking with noted paleoanthropologist Lee Berger, author of the new book, Cave of Bones, A True Story of Discovery, Adventure, and Human Origins. And he's also featured in the Netflix documentary, Unknown, Cave of Bones. Let's get right to the interview. Hi, Lee. Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, it's great to be here.
To start off, just really generally, how should listeners understand the mission and the challenges of paleoanthropology?
So paleoanthropology is, in its loosest definition, the search for understanding human origins, but it's a little broader than that. It's also hominin origins. And the reason I make that distinction is that we humans tend to self-center everything around ourselves. And hominins are bipedal apes that are part of our journey, but they're not all our direct ancestors, if you will. There's been a mass, an almost braided stream of ancient relatives that walked on two legs that are closer related to us than chimpanzees and gorillas are. So there, if you imagine evolution of sort of coming from a last common ancestor, gorillas broke off first, then chimpanzees, bonobos break off, and all the rest of that story between us and that moment are the hominins as we evolved bipedalism and special adaptations. We also, though, study not only the physical morphology, the kind of the way that evolution happens, we study the culture of these ancient species. And that's going to be, I think, particularly important to these most recent discoveries.
Now, you were previously the Philip Tobias Chair in Paleoanthropology at the University of Witwatersrand. I know you've taken on some new titles recently. What is your role now with National Geographic, and how does all of this factor into your other positions and your work?
Right. So I am an explorer in residence, is my primary job at National Geographic Society. I'm also a senior Carnegie Science Fellow. That's a very recent appointment, as I've joined that organization largely to push the sort of hard sciences in our field and the relationship between that remarkable group of scientists and organization. I still maintain a position at WITS as an honorary professor, and I'm director of the Center for the Exploration of the Deep Human Journey. So all of those intersect with each other. I run a very large science program that has a sort of collaborative, collegial group of scientists from around the world of over 160 at this time. It's growing almost on a daily basis as that. So it's a very large science program. Some of those are based in the sort of traditional university setting. Others of them are based in sort of institutional things like Carnegie or museums.
Now, the book is Cave of Bones, a true story of discovery, adventure, and human origins. And then, of course, we also have the Netflix documentary, Unknown, Cave of Bones. They take readers and viewers to a particular cave system in South Africa. Can you tell us about the Rising Star Cave Complex?
So the Rising Star Cave Complex came deeply into my life in 2013. I'd known about it before then. It was a very well-known system of caves where amateur cavers, and I'd even caved in the 1990s, just outside of Johannesburg, South Africa. Imagine, if you will, a huge network of subterranean system, almost 4 kilometers long. So what is that, 2.5 miles or so of underground passages, networks, small and somewhat larger cave systems that goes down maybe 200 feet or so before you hit groundwater. But it's hard to describe for people who tend to think of like the big mammoth cave systems. Mm-hmm. It's a latticework cave. So it's like skyscrapers that are buried in the ground with different floors. And you can move and traverse up and down these, and it can be impossibly difficult. And so both the book and the Netflix documentary followed us over a period of almost a year as we were testing the idea of whether we had discovered burials in a non-human species. And that is a species called Homo naledi, which is a very small-brained hominin. It's a brain slightly larger than a chimpanzee, but it was a biped. It walked on two legs and existed sort of out of time and place. If we looked at a hominin like that, we would normally think, it's 2.5 million years old based on its entire anatomy. It turned out that Homo naledi is much younger than that, something like 240,000 to 330,000 years before present. So in finding these possible burials, and we go through that sort of period of analysis and looking at in this deep, dark chamber, almost 350 feet back into a system, we knew it was going to be one of the most controversial things ever said. Because until that moment of seeing those, the idea was that really only humans and things very much like humans, like Neanderthals, bury their dead. It was our gig. One of the last things we had that separated ourselves from the animal kingdom and animal behavior. And so both the Netflix show and the book carry us through that period and then to what I kind of refer to as 72 hours of remarkable discovery, where I ended up losing about 55 pounds and got down into this incredibly difficult to get to space where only 46 people had been before, almost died in the process of doing that. I needed answers to some questions before we published that burial paper that really I kind of only had the broad experience to answer. And it was at that point that I discovered etchings on the wall, engravings on the wall, and evidence of fire on the roof. And then that kind of broke everything free because we suddenly realized there was evidence of fire everywhere. And so now we're at this kind of moment where my colleagues and I have announced to the world that we believe we have discovered the first non-human species culture in history.
Yes, having watched the documentary and read the book, this is just really mind-blowing. I'm not even sure of which direction to start with first, like just the sheer challenges of the cave system or just how potentially profound the discoveries are. I guess maybe starting with the setting a little bit, before you even ventured down there to the main chamber, how did you go about carrying out these explorations, like with the command center and right, finding the right people to send down there?
So when I was first shown where this material was, I sent my then 15-year-old, very skinny son down there to verify that it was real. And I was shown by these two amateur cavers that I had enlisted where this was. I knew I would never get into that space. You know, if you imagine this vertical squeeze that moves in various directions. It squeezes down to 7.5 inches in places. I used to joke my ego would never fit, much less my physique. I designed a system to work in the space based on I've been very close friends with both James Cameron and Bob Ballard, and have been admirers of the way they've handled their expeditions, which include, you know, sort of deep sea work where you can't often go to these places. Now, James did, of course, but and so is Bob, but you can't often go to these places. So they use remote operation. They use, you know, tethered operations and using remote operated vehicles. And so I designed a system where I could be in that kind of command center. It's also based loosely on NASA as well. And then I found my own remote operated people, which I put a Facebook ad out and with, you know, looking for skinny scientists that had the skills to climb and cave and work in extreme environments. And I selected six just remarkable scientists who just happened to be women. And that journey has continued, and we've constantly advanced the technology. We have Wi-Fi in the cave now. It's a lot more sophisticated, but we still have all that hard wiring that goes in there. And I sit at the top with other scientists, and we monitor and watch over their shoulders and help them excavate the few people that could get into that space. It was a lot of fun, very dramatic. I'll admit at times frustrating that, you know, mm-hmm. I couldn't be there, and they would bring each piece out after, you know, carefully excavating it, documenting it, and then it would become part of a broader study. It's an extreme environment. It's an environment that can kill you, and I think it's probably pretty unique amongst the world's, you know, search for human origins. A pretty unique environment to actually be physically working in, and constantly adapting and changing. I mean, the way you do it. I think you can actually see that probably better in the book than the documentary, where you actually feel as we keep adapting things along the way, trying to improvise and make it better as we hit roadblocks.
Yeah, I found both the documentary and the book were highly illustrative in different ways. I mean, obviously, we're getting some of the actual footage in the documentary, but you have some wonderful illustrations in the book that, you know, just lay out exactly how the cave system is oriented. And then your descriptions of when you actually go down and then have to ascend back up, some of that was just very harrowing to read.
It gives me PTSD even reading that, and I wrote it. it was also tough to watch that on the Netflix doc movie. You can imagine, because the for your listeners, what ultimately happened was, after deciding that we couldn't go forward with the Beryl publication until we sort of sorted out a few critical questions, I decided to make the attempt in, you know, turning 57, wasn't going to be many times I was going to be able to attempt an extreme journey like this. And so I lost the weight, got in there. I knew it was going to be terrible, because I've told the world how terrible it is. I had no idea how awful it was. And it was a very strange experience. You know, I've been an explorer all my life, and I've been in life and death situations several times, but this was different because I was having to make conscious choices to push beyond places that I really did know deep in my mind I might not be able to get back out of. And those are hard. You learn a lot about yourself in those sort of moments when you make a choice like that and pass through it. Going down was awful. Coming up was the most terrible and wonderful thing in my whole life. I had to make a decision. You know, I tried to remove a body part, you know, because I was stuck. Mm-hmm. And I'd never been in that situation before. You know, I'd never been in the kind of situation where you have to make a decision to try and hurt yourself to get out of something. Mm-hmm. And you learn a lot about yourself in that situation too. But I'm here now. I obviously did get out. But it's about as close to not surviving an event as I've ever been.
Like, even the names of sort of the three phases to get down to that main chamber, it implies this kind of mythic journey. You have like the Superman crawl, which already sounds harrowing. You go up the dragon's back, which sounds very mythic, but then the chute, right? The chute is the real choke point here.
That's right. So, you know, Superman's crawl, by the way, is just named because you had to extend one arm in the kind of flying Superman pose to fit through it. Most people didn't. There was this awful rock in the middle of it that you had to crawl over. And then you enter this giant, beautiful chamber, dragon's back, and up this jagged series of rocks. It's almost 40 feet tall, which if you fall off, you die, you know, kind of thing. And then you get to the top and you stare down into this crevasse, into this labyrinth of narrow squeezes and things. And, you know, you slide in there and down you go in a place that there's no point in it, that rocks aren't pressing on both sides of your chest, almost no point in it that you can maneuver your head anywhere but down, and usually at an angle, because it's just narrow enough to, and just wide enough to, you know, a helmet to fit. It's tough. It's a hard space, but it is, you know, while I was in there too, though, you can actually see that Homo Naledi, who was thinner than we were, who had a smaller head than we were, who had more powerful hands, grasping hands and powerful shoulders, would have moved through there very different. We're just a bunch of big, clumsy apes in a space we're not supposed to be. And they would have, I think, moved through there very, very differently.
We think they would have been arboreal or more arboreal than us, right?
So I careful about arboreal, better okay. climbers. Arboreal means trees. I think they could have done very well in trees, obviously, and almost certainly climbed them. But I think they were very good rock climbers too.
Okay.
And they have these curved fingers and these powerful joints, and they're very light in build. So I think they would have been very, very good rock climbers.
Yeah, I love one of the parts in the book where you're talking about having to navigate the chute, and you're imagining them moving rather effortlessly through that same space.
Yeah, I had a lot of time in that space, and a lot more time than I'd like to think about. And, you know, part of what I was doing there was also looking around and seeing the space in a very different way. When the first explorers had gone in there, the space is so narrow that you really can't get cameras in there to give any reflection about what is. We can't get basic measuring tools, or we couldn't. We now have done that. And so it took on this sort of mythical thing of the chute that mm-hmm. you talk about, and actually was even drawn by some of our, in our early scientific papers, as a tube, you know, this vertical tube from one place to the other, and it's not at all. It turns out it's a labyrinth, and I'm not sure how that sort of mythology got stuck even into the science. We're now rewriting that, but that's why I call it the chute labyrinth now. It's not a uniform pipe. Why is all this so important? Because this is one of the hardest things that people have to understand, why this place is special and why would Naledi go to all that effort just to put its dead in there? It's so many people who it's very interesting as people talk to me about this. They go, but why would they do that? And, you know, I had a very interesting experience. I was in London recently, and I was talking to someone about this, and we were sitting up on one of those high buildings in central London. The cathedral was right behind it, and their back was to the cathedral, and I was looking at them, and they said, you know, why would anyone, I just can't understand why they would go to such effort for their dead. And I went, you know, I just gestured with my hand out the window to this gigantic cathedral that mm-hmm. tens of thousands of people had built, all as a tribute to death. And, you know, we go to huge, huge efforts to deal with that. We build ossuaries. We build catacombs under major cities. We build pyramids. We build cathedrals. We dig holes 6 feet in the ground when there's no need to and put bodies in them. And yet here we sit as humans go, but why would someone go to that extent for their loved ones? And the answer is because they did. Even though they didn't have our brain, even though they didn't, you know, they aren't us, they clearly carried those same emotions and feelings about death and perhaps the afterlife and things like that, but certainly the emotions of death and love to make sure that their kin did not undergo the often horrific processes that occur to things that are just left to the decay process, or in Africa, the process of scavenging that goes on outside, which is not particularly pleasant. Whatever was their motivation, they did that thing.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay. Picture this, it's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road, the steeper the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Now, as you discussed, there are, of course, other ways that bones can find their way into caves and cave systems. How do we eliminate such possibilities as predators bringing bones down or water washing them down into the complex?
So that's just from a process of scientific analysis and also a process of elimination. If carnivores or scavengers are dealing with the dead, then they leave marks on them. They leave tooth marks, scratch marks, they dismember. They're doing it almost certainly to eat the bodies, you know, because they're not collecting humans. Mm-hmm. That's our hominins. And so that leaves very characteristic damage. So that doesn't exist on this very, very large sample of Homo naledi. And we're over 30 individuals, remember, and thousands of bones. So there's no evidence of that. So you can eliminate scavengers and predators. Then you get to the point of, well, how do you know they just all didn't go down there and die? So the first part of that was, well, if they did, only one species did that. That is, they went again and again, and they did it over time. We can see that there are events imposed on events. So there's time involved in the accumulation. So that would be odd. It wouldn't be impossible. But that was actually, for the first several years, our initial hypothesis that they were perhaps being brought there and just left there. It was only when we then began to see that the floor was actually not a bone bed. It was actually a sterile floor that then was interrupted by a pit or hole dug into the floor. That material was removed, disrupting part of the sedimentary layers in the floor. A fleshed body was put in, and the reason we know that is that parts of the bodies are articulated, and you can see how the body it compressed itself in the sediments as it deteriorated, as the spaces decayed within it. And then that body was covered with dirt, the same dirt from the hole. We can see the mixed up sedimentary layers. And then the body underwent natural collapse and decay in the material sediment. And we can show all that. You can show that through the analysis of the sedimentology and the structure. Some people I know don't like that. And one of the reasons is that simply we consider calling that a grave or a burial a human thing. And so, you know, if you don't want to call it a grave, then it is a hole dug into the floor with a body in it covered with dirt. You can call that what you want, but the implication is that they did that. Oh, sorry, by the way. You asked about water. Water leaves very characteristic geological signatures. When water moves sediment, anyone who's been to a stream can see what happens when water moves sediment. You get sorting, you get different sized rocks and pebbles and things. So there's no sign of that. There's no significant water movement of anything in that cave system.
Now, in terms of them bringing the dead down through the cave system to this this chamber, it's thought then that they would have had fire. They would have had some sort of light.
So we can see evidence of fire on the roof of that chamber. There's soot blackened into the flowstones that have grown over it. In fact, while I was in the chamber, my colleague, Dr. Kanelwe Moliopane, was in Dragon's Back doing an excavation and discovered at the same moment I was in there, a hearth. She uncovered a hearth where they had been cooking animal remains in the adjacent chamber. Now, that's kind of cool because there are no animal remains in the Dinaletti chamber where the burials are. There are animal remains in the Dragon's Back chamber, but there are no Dinaletti remains in the Dragon's Back chamber. So you've got this what appears to be two differential uses of space. One where they cooked animal remains, the other where they buried their dead.
Wow. Now, coming back to this crosshatch, tell us about this crosshatch you discovered. And I mean, and there are so many additional follow-up, like the similarities to other marks that have been discovered. Like, what are we to make of all of this?
So when I got into the cave, I had one of these, and I it's worth telling that moment again, because it was a really interesting moment. I decided I was not going to take any digital images or pictures because I've been watching this thing through a digital screen for 7 years. And so I decided to narrate it, to just talk. And if you watch the Netflix documentary, you'll actually see me talking into a cell phone as I narrate, because I think that sometimes you see things better when you're forced to storytell as you explain things. And I was narrating the space, and it was clear to me almost immediately that my explorers and our team, our colleagues, had missed things. And one was the space had been altered. You could actually see where things like flowstones, that's a layer of lime, like a rock, had been broken and moved uphill. And so it was very clear to me that we had misunderstood that they had interacted with this space. And as I was narrating that, there's this passageway that runs from where we land, just after the chute labyrinth, where we land, called the Hill Antechamber. There's a doorway that goes between there and the next chamber, which is Dinaletti Chamber, another burial chamber. And as I looked at that doorway, you can hear me say, wow, it looks like a door. It's smaller than I, and then you hear me pause, because I'm an archaeologist. You know, I spent my life around doorways. And what we humans put around doorways always is some meaning signs. We tell you what's on the other side of the doorway, or who's behind the doorway, or all the or exit, or bathroom here, or whatever the signal is. And I saw these non-natural etchings in the wall. I couldn't believe it. Squares, rectangles, triangles, equal signs, crosses, right side up and upside down. Mm-hmm. And there was even this sort of fish-shaped thing that, you know, that may not be what their intent of it was, but looks like a fish-shaped thing with an X in it. And it appears to have been covered with some substance. And I could not believe what I was looking at. And my explorers had walked right by that. And that's largely because of pathfinder syndrome. You know, once people have been in a space, they develop a sort of backyard syndrome. It becomes too familiar and you quit looking at the space around you because you know that it's been seen. Mm-hmm. Do that experiment at home where you, you know, if you right now draw your own kitchen from memory and then draw a place that you've just entered, the place you've just entered, you'll draw better than your kitchen because you've amalgamated your kitchen into a safe environment. And you'll be surprised how poorly you actually do that thing. And so I saw that and I turned on a black light. I always carry a UV light with me because many minerals fluoresce in caves. And I had this hallucination. I had this an optical light shift as they floated. You've seen like Queen's Gambit or something where you see the chess mm-hmm. pieces move in the air above or a beautiful mind and the equations come. And that happened to me. And scientifically, I know it happens, you know, because I created an optical light shift like you do when you look in your rearview mirror at night. And you've ever noticed how the headlights float away from the light of the mm-hmm. headlights. That's a neural processing thing that's going on in your brain. And so I know why it happened, but it freaked me out completely as it happened. I had to shut the light off and I was embarrassed about it. And because it, you know, they moved. And then later found the hashtag on the way out, which is it's a cross hatch or that. And it has all these little pounding marks in it where it looks like it's been pounded hundreds and hundreds of times. You can see the little pitting. And you can see those in the illustration in the book, all these hundreds of little pits that are done. And, you know, and then they share these similarities. You know, we were having a beer after I got out of it and I took one cell phone picture while I was down there, and that was of this crosshatch. And I showed it to John Hawks and Augustine Fuentes. And I just turned it, and immediately Augustine leapt up and said, "I need my car keys," and he ran away. And I was like, "What?" And John Hawks started looking like a teenager on his cell phone. And I'm like holding this, and I'm like, you know, I almost died to get this picture, at least. And both of them turned around with their phones simultaneously and showed me the Gibraltar Gorham's Cave crosshatch etching that had been done by a Neanderthal 60,000 years ago. And it's the same. And I remember that moment so vividly because when I looked at John's, I thought, why is he photoshopping the crosshatch I just took and making it blue? And then I realized he doesn't have the picture. I'm the only one with the picture. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the remarkable thing was these are two of the few people in the entire planet who'd physically seen that. And so their mind immediately went to that. And of course, there are also similarities with the oldest geometric engravings from places like Blombos that are attributed to Homo sapiens at 78,000 years. Why is that? That's something that we're working on right now. We've assembled a team of neural scientists, people who study geometric rock art, artists. I suspect it's because it's part of the shared mind of our deep ancestry. And that I suspect that those shared symbols, which, by the way, are all very familiar to us today, they're the symbols we use for mathematics, music, these type of things. And I suspect that they may have something to do with the way we formulate math, the way we formulate language. In sort of a symbolic way inside of our head. And I think it comes from very deep time. I think that's the only way to really explain how they're shared between three species that really have almost no connection to each other at those temporal periods. And also, I think, you know, we kind of knew that must be true, the way geometric rock art around the world all looks the same. And that there's clearly something inside of us. And there was something in Naledi, and there's something in Neanderthals. So it's kind of cool to think maybe as this science goes on that what those panels inside of that, those burial chambers really are is the Rosetta Stone to the mind. And maybe we can begin to unlock that.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, just looking at like the comparison, I guess like you can imagine that the simplest way of looking at it would be like, okay, I make right angles that don't occur in nature that frequently. And this kind of marks this as a place where I've, you know, impressed my will, but then there seems to be so much else going on with these markings in addition to that.
Absolutely. And I think that part of the fun is that, you know, we've never really had markings from another species to compare to. That's always, you know, even the Neanderthal ones, one, it's a singular event. And two, mm-hmm. although there's now beginning to emerge some other rock art by Neanderthals, but they have a big brain, you know, they have this gigantic, huge brain. And so they're kind of us. This is by something that doesn't have our brain. And so I think part of the real excitement going forward is going to be, what do they mean? Can we ever know what they mean? You know, I have hope with things like neural imaging. And, you know, you've seen some of these experiments where they can actually visualize what the brain is seeing. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, a friend of mine, Brian Muirescu, who wrote The Immortality Key, when I showed him some of the images, he was just happened to be in London. He'd just come out of this experiment where he was watching people be given psychedelics. And then they were asked to draw what they're seeing, and they draw those same images. Hmm. You know, there's something there. And maybe this will be what we need to break through that.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Now, you talk about the experience of being in that cave, and this is obviously like a novel environment for you. And I guess it would,
pardon the pun,
yes, but it would have also been a novel environment for the Homo naledi as well, right? Do you feel like there is, and maybe this is just stretching too far, is there any kind of, you think there's any kind of like kinship between like the way you interpret such an environment, how your senses adapt to such an environment, and what they might have experienced?
You know, I speak about, I think, the experience of being in caves a lot in the book. And, you know, caves are not natural to humans. They're not our space. Even though we use the term like caveman all the time, the evidence that humans go deep into cave systems is a very, very recent phenomenon, by and large. I mean, there are a few exceptions, but we don't like to move beyond the twilight zone, you know, where there's still light filtering in. It's just not our space. Naledi clearly was much more comfortable in those spaces. Having said that, when you're in those spaces and, you know, your whole focus narrows down to artificial lighting and you lose a sense of sound, because sound isn't very important to you in those spaces. And so you lose that, but your sense of touch is increased and these things. And you start seeing these spaces and things in these artificial lights, and fire, by the way, is artificial light, of course. They do have an effect on you. And I think that, you know, if you think about the spaces that humans term as symbolic or sacred or whatever, we're often kind of replicating that cathedral-like ceilings, the idea of disassociation of places that are natural to you. We tend to lower light levels, you know, and change the way that your eye is perceiving things. And, you know, and flame is particularly good at that because it can add motion. And it can add the perception of movement in spaces like this. And so you know, I think that they are powerful spaces. I don't want, you know, I'm a scientist. I'm trying to not go there, but they do affect you when you're in these spaces, and particularly when you understand that, you know, as I guess I did very deeply, that, you know, they chose this space. And they chose this space for their dead. And you'd have to have a pretty cold heart for that not to affect you when you're in a space like that.
So it's possible then that what we're seeing, it was certainly is a ritual behavior, but then is it the sort of thing that, it, at least broadly speaking, like over time, that ritual takes on other meanings and maybe like religious ideas emerge out of that?
I've got to be very careful because, you know, there are thousands of colleagues with daggers on when you use the word ritual loosely or what it has, because these have human meaning. And you know, we're dealing with a non-human, at least at the grade level of anatomy, and you're dealing with a non-human. So where this takes you, I don't know. I think that's going to be part of the next years and decades excitement. We're going to go there. I mean, they have use this entire subterranean space. They have altered it. We don't have evidence that they're living there. What they appear to be doing is interacting with at least the deeper spaces in these ways. And, you know, I have some colleagues who say that it must be spirituality and religion. You know, it's a form of religion. I don't think we can be there yet, but, you know, the fact is that the last couple of decades have shown us the arrogance of human exceptionalism. And you know, as we've begun to actually more openly study animal behavior, we understand now, of course, that cetaceans have culture, elephants have culture, that other primates have cultures, that chimps and gorillas certainly have cultures. And yet we had eliminated that from things that are closer to us, like Homo naledi. And I think we have to start the field over in some ways. I think we have to start again. I mean, we had approached everything as if the null hypothesis of finding a dead hominin body was natural. You had to explain it naturally, as opposed to the null hypothesis being cultural. And I think that was a mistake. I think it was a mistake. And I think a big thing that's going to come out of this moment in history is a recognition that we had made an error as science. We had deculturalized things that clearly must have had culture. And in doing that, we weren't seeing their cultures. And I will bet you that what will flow out of this discovery and this moment is a new acceptance of these ancient human relatives being cultural beings. And I think that's really exciting, because that will lead us into not missing things in the way we have missed things before.
Absolutely. Now coming back to the book particularly, and specifically, you've authored other books before. What really propelled this book into being? What led you to write, and what did you really want to get out there with Cave of Bones?
So this book started as a completely different book. It literally started as a follow-up, a five-year follow-up to Almost Human, which was the first book on the discovery of Homo naledi and what that meant. And it was meant to take all of the research that had been done and kind of synthesize it to where we were. And we were in a very strange place when I began developing the concept of this book with my co-author, John Hawks. And that is, we had one of the best known hominid species ever discovered, but all we had were its bones. And so it was meant to be this kind of journey around the state of where we were and ending with this sort of, but we need more. And then the burials were discovered. And that became the center of the book because, you know, I literally thought when those burials, when we recognized that those were holes in the ground dug with bodies in them covered by dirt from the hole, I thought that was going to be the biggest discovery of my life. You know, here we were, you know, we're right into now this sacred space of humanity, you know, burial of the dead and all the things you talked about that spill out of that self-recognition of mortality, possibly spirituality, all those things fall deeply from that. And then I got in the chamber and saw the symbols and you're like, wow. The fire, funny enough, was never surprising. Fire's been around for millions of years. I mean, of course they had fire. It just was, I had talked our entire team out of the that the evidence for fire was going to be easy to see, and it was right in front of us the entire time. So, you know, that was my fault. But you know, the symbols are a different level of stuff. But all that in combination is the book. And it became a journey. And the book became very, we trashed the first version of the book, and then it became very easy to write. And I actually wrote it very, very quickly because it was a narrative journey of a very deeply personal experience with the discovery of the species, discovery of the culture around the species. And in the end, it gave me the chance to explore meaning and in a very open way and discuss some of these concepts of human exceptionalism and where I think this field is going.
Awesome. Well, the documentary kicks off with a great sense of mystery, and I also have to say, like, the book just really, like, literally throws you right into the cave. There you are in the cave. It has a very, I think sometimes people might, some listeners might be hesitant to pick up a book about this topic, but I mean, really, this one just throws you right into the cave. It has a very riveting beginning and just doesn't let go for the entire length.
Oh, thank you for saying so. I mean, it's been a very personal journey for me. It's and I think that you know, there's a lot of meaning in Homo naledi and a lot of good that that humans as individuals can take out from understanding that there have been other species with complex cultures. This thing that we're living right now, it's neither the first, nor is it some sort of God-given right to be, because it's happened before. And I think that's an important message. You know, the idea that, you know, because I think that anyone who looks around the planet understands that the idea of human exceptionalism is part of why we do so much damage to this place. Mm. We think we own it. And we think it was given to us. And by learning that there have been other experiments in this, you know, maybe we should step off of that high horse or stool or whatever and step down a little bit. But as we kind of are at this critical moment in human history where literally the balance of life on this planet is at stake because of us.
All right. Well, we have the book, we have the documentary, we have the additional books. Where else can listeners go to learn more and or follow your work?
Right. So you can follow me on Twitter at Lee R. Berger. I'm also on Facebook at Prof. Lee Berger. If you follow National Geographic, you know, we're there a lot, presence in that space. And there's going to be more. And there are the older writings. You know, it's quite fun if you go back and read Skull in the Rock, Almost Human, and then this chapter, because it's kind of a narrative of the history of this science. And even further back, Footsteps of Eve, which was in the 1990s, where you can actually kind of understand the evolution of this whole science over the last 30 plus years that at least from my perspective, that I've experienced it in, you know, what has got to be the greatest age of exploration we're living through right now.
Awesome. Well, thank you once more for coming on the show, talking about your work, the book, the documentary. It's been a pleasure.
It's great to be here.
Thanks again to Lee Berger for coming on the show here. The book again is Cave of Bones, A True Story of Discovery, Adventure, and Human Origins, and it's out now in physical, digital, and audio formats. The documentary, Unknown, Cave of Bones, is currently streaming on Netflix. Thanks, as always, to the excellent J.J. Posway for producing the show. And if you want to reach out to us, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.